next case in our calendar is 98-12-27, Cuyahoga County Bar Association versus Donald Williams. Ms. Bell.
Yes, please, report. I'm Mary Alston Donald, and I, along with Charles W. Kettlewell, represent Donald Williams, the respondent in this matter. We would like to ask to reserve 5 minutes of our time for rebuttal by Mr. Kettlewell. Thank you. We're here today on 4 main issues. The first issue is the panel's denial of the latest 11-hour request to amend its complaint. We submit that denial, in fact, was appropriate based upon the undue delay, undue prejudice, and bad faith of the respondent to the unrelated. And we will, in fact...
You mean respondent's request, right?
No.
Okay.
No, Your Honor. It's related to the request to amend its complaint. And we submit that the undue delay, undue prejudice, and bad faith was on behalf of the relator.
You know, they sent to me.
I'm sorry. Our second issue deals with the panel's findings of fact. And we submit stipulations of fact and the evidence in the record do not support the findings as set forth by the panel. And in fact, the relator does not prove those findings by clear and convincing evidence, which is their burden to prove. Our third issue deals with the Neely deposition, and we submit that was and is a discoverable document and always has been. The third issue deals with the sanction recommended by the board and the court, and we submit that that sanction is not appropriate, especially in light of the fact that the panel precluded the introduction of evidence into the record of our client's state of mind at the time that the offenses allegedly occurred. And this court has said that there are 4 factors to be considered when determining an appropriate sanction in a disciplinary case, and the state of mind is one of those 4 factors. If I can go back to our first issue and give you some flesh onto why we raised that issue. The relator suggests that it should have had the opportunity to amend at the 11th hour its complaint. We submit that they should not have been able to do so. Our basis for that is the relator had in its possession for 104 days prior to the filing of the formal complaint against our client the allegations that gave rise to its amended request for complaint. Under Governance Rule 5, 104 days is more than sufficient time to investigate, 60 days to investigate, 30 days to come to a decision, but they in fact had that evidence in their possession in sufficient time to have brought that forward with their original complaint. If in fact they chose not to bring it forward originally, they had 2 years during the pendency of this case to conduct an additional investigation and to amend a complaint. They chose again not to do that. They waited until September 22, 1997, when Master Commissioner Milligan ordered the production of Ms. Neely's deposition, in which these allegations were contained, to first raise these issues at Mr. Williams' deposition. Master Commissioner Milligan made an off-the-record ruling that relator, in fact, could not amend his complaint. Despite this ruling, relator put these additional allegations in its pre-hearing brief, which was filed just 4 days before the hearing. Given the fact that it was nearly 4 days before the hearing, it was insufficient time for respondent to conduct an investigation. Matter of fact, my client only found one of the parties the evening before trial. And I would submit that undue delay. They had it for 104 days before they filed the original complaint. They had it for 2 years. They could have investigated. If they chose to, they did not. Undue prejudice, the inability of respondent to, in fact, gather sufficient evidence to effectively defend himself of those charges, and bad faith in that they secreted the very document that had the allegations in it from respondent for 2 years and forced us to file motions to compel, forced us to argue against the reconsideration motion, and only after the camera inspection of Master Commissioner Milligan was in fact this document produced to us. We submit that that in fact is undue delay, undue prejudice, and bad faith, and therefore their 11-hour request to amend their complaint was justifiably denied. With respect to our second issue, that deals with the actual facts that were presented to the panel at the hearing, as well as the stipulations that were presented to the hearing. There were 4 counts in the complaint. complaint, the panel found that the relator had proven three counts. We respectfully suggest that, in fact, those facts were not proven by clear and convincing evidence, unless explained why. With respect to the finding that my client engaged in dishonesty, deceit, or misrepresentation, the only information that is contained in the panel's findings with respect to that are utterances that my client made concerning Mr. Austin. During the trial, we attempted three different times to introduce into evidence the truthfulness of those statements. The hearing panel precluded us from entering into evidence the truthfulness of those statements. Yet, they seemed to make the finding that, in fact, those statements were either dishonesty, deceit, or misrepresentation, yet denied us the opportunity to, in fact, prove that they were truthful. We submit that the relator had the burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence my client engaged in dishonesty, deceit, or misrepresentation, and the denial to respondent of submitting into evidence the truthfulness of those statements, in fact, denied him his due process rights, and that to make that finding is not consistent with the record. The evidence that, in fact, the relator did put into the record is not clear and convincing evidence on the issue of dishonesty, deceit, and misrepresentation. With respect to Ms. Taylor Noyes, which is count one of the relator's complaint, there was a stipulation that, in fact, there were four cases handled by the respondent's law firm prior to January of 1994. However, a panel makes the finding that there were only three cases. So one of their initial findings is in contradiction to the facts that were stipulated between the relator and the respondent. And we suggest that's just one of the instances to show that, in fact, the facts, as the panel found them, are not consistent with the record. In addition, there was testimony that there, in fact, was no communication between our client and Ms. Taylor Noyes prior to her new injury, after she discharged my client from Mr. Austin, until she suffered a new injury. She fell on March 28, 1994. Shortly after her fall, her son, Tony Salamino, contacted the Ashtabula Law Firm of Nicholson and Pontius and requested legal representation on behalf of his injured mother. That law firm contacted Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams then contacted Ms. Taylor Noyes and went to see her in the hospital. We submit that exhibit that contains Mr. Coxon's testimony in lieu of, his deposition in lieu of testimony at trial, in fact, supports that Ms. Taylor Noyes' agent, if you will, contacted a lawyer and asked for legal representation. That, in fact, that was the only reason that prompted Mr. Williams to go to the hospital room to see Ms. Taylor Noyes. He went there, and she retained his firm on the new case. She also then re-retained his firm on the pending four cases. And when she got out of the hospital, on April 8th of 1994, she actually went to the law offices of Nicholson and Pontius and delivered to them pay stubs and other documentation with respect to the new injury. And relator submits that, in fact, Mr. Austin represented Ms. Taylor Noyes on the new injury. We submit that, first, her actions are inconsistent with that position because, in fact, she brought documents to the law firm that she had asked her son to assist her in seeking representation. And in addition, by her own testimony, she testified that she vacillated back and forth between Mr. Williams and Mr. Austin, and she really didn't know who she wanted. Matter of fact, she made a statement to the trial that they probably thought she was crazy because she kept going back and forth and back and forth. We submit then that there is not clear and convincing evidence, contrary to the panel's finding, that in fact Mr. Austin represented Ms. Taylor Noyes on March 28th 1994 when she had that accident with respect to that new case. The facts just don't support that finding. It's clear by Plaintiff's Exhibit 16, and the record will later refer to their exhibits as Plaintiff's Exhibits, that on April 12, 1994, Ms. Taylor Moyes made a written statement under oath before a notary that in fact she wanted to retain Mr. Austin as her lawyer for the new case and for all the other prior cases. The very convincing evidence is that as of April 12, 1994, several weeks after the contact between Ms. Taylor Moyes and Mr. Williams, she decided to go back to Mr. Austin. With respect to Ms. Bookbinder, that's count three of the letter's complaint. First, there were stipulations that in fact Ms. Bookbinder was represented by the Williams Law Firm from February of 1986 through the end of January of 1994. During that period of time, the law firm, in fact, had a number of workers' compensation cases for Ms. Bookbinder. One of those cases resulted in the payment of a check for permanent partial disability, the check covering the period from January 1, 1991 through April 17, 1992, clearly a period of time in which Mr. Williams's law firm represented Ms. Bookbinder. That check came into the Williams law firm on March 28, 1994. Immediately upon receipt, Mr. Williams contacted Ms. Bookbinder and said, the check is here, so all you have to do is sign your name and the two-thirds that belongs to you is yours. He told her that again in writing, and he repeatedly told her that. Ms. Bookbinder's own testimony is what stopped her from going to Mr. Williams' law firm to receive that check was Mr. Austin telling her, if you sign that check without letting me put some special words on the back, you're going to lose some future benefits. Well, Mr. Williams told her, he's telling you the incorrect law. That's not correct. You can sign this check and you can still file for the paragraph A. You don't need any special words on the back of that check. Now, we submit that the stipulated testimony of the expert witness, Alan Shapiro, confirms that, in fact, Mr. Williams gave the correct legal advice to Ms. Bookbinder, and the incorrect legal advice was given to Ms. Bookbinder by Mr. Austin. And we can speculate only that Mr. Austin gave that advice so that the check would come into his possession. And ultimately, that's what happened. Ms. Bookbinder refused to sign the check under any circumstances other than the check being in the hands of Mr. Austin. And that's ultimately what happened. And if we may, Your Honor, I reserve the rest of the time for Mr. Cavallo. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Cavallo.
Your Honor, I'm pleased to court for Ms. Lester Potash, and I'm here on behalf of the Relator of the County Bar Association. Your Honor, I think that the most essential qualities that we possess, I think that what helps to define us as to what we are and what we do, are those professionalism and stability. Without that, we can be successful, we can be intelligent, we can also be brilliant and help people, but we're going to be people who have a law degree as opposed to attorneys at law. I think in this instance, looking at the entire transcript from the hearing that took place before the panel, the conclusion can be reached that is on some day in January 1994, Mr. Williams, in his office in the Terminal Tower, summoned his professionalism, summoned his civility, opened the window, and just pushed him out. And went full force against Greg Austin. And how he went full force against Greg Austin is what brought us here today. Had this been any other type of man, had a businessman come before Mr. Williams and said, you know, my partner is stealing me blinds, stealing my customers, he is ruining my business, he's trashing my name, I need help. I would hope that Mr. Williams, as a lawyer, would say, we can try to get a restraining order, file an action, do something to get you relief. I would hope Mr. Williams would not say that we're going to go to the customers directly, we're going to say that your former partner is crazy, he's an adulterer, he wears an earring, he's nuts, he's trying to cheat you, he doesn't know the law, he's incompetent. Because those very words were spoken to the very clients who came, who were, and this is what's very bizarre. Mr. Williams talks about the fact these are long-time clients. I've known these people all these years. They have been me for many cases and their families and so forth. Yet apparently upon the breakup, not of the Williams firm, but of the Williams Austin cider firm, a choice was made by each one of these people. And regardless of how long they intended to, or how long they were with Mr. Williams, they decided Mr. Williams was no longer their lawyer. It wasn't a question, it wasn't an inference, it wasn't something to be drawn from other facts. These were documents that were signed by each and every one of these people saying, I don't want Mr. Williams, I want Mr. Austin. And you have before you the letter that went out by Mr. Austin. It didn't say Mr. Williams is getting old, he's slowing down, it's time for the new generation to take over. It said the firm's breaking up. You have a right to who you wish to represent, to who you wish to represent. You.
Michael, let's assume just for the sake of argument that those allegations were true.
Any allegations about Mr. Austin?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's say for the sake of argument they were true.
Sure.
If they were true, would that make a difference in the case?
No.
And why not?
Well, if I owe $50 to a bill collector, the bill collector publishes the plain bill, or I owe that guy $50, that may be true, but that's invaded my privacy. That's caused the collection.
What if he feels that the tax is client, he has an obligation to tell them that there's somebody who may be doing a part of the
tax? At what point, Judge? I'm just, if we were at the point after the client said, I want Mr. Austin, he is my lawyer, I think there's a problem. And that's exactly what happened here. It wasn't during the interim where they were uncertain, you know, Mr. Williams all these years, Mr. Austin's done me good, Williams Austin. No, I chose Austin in January 94. He's my man, he's my lawyer, I want him to represent me. This is all after the fact. The woman's in the hospital under pain medication. She doesn't know what planet she's on, let alone who her lawyer is. And in comes Mr. Williams saying, you gotta be my lawyer. You got 24 hours to give me that case, because he's not going to get it over my dead body. Now the question is that proper? I would submit that that is not what we wish to represent to the public. And the question further becomes, it boggles my mind.
How did you truly evaluate the comments he made if you couldn't look at them? In other words, if you had prevented the other side from saying any other evidence as to whether the comment
is
truth or not, how can you totally evaluate the situation?
The comment as to what? That he's an adulterer? How does that, we're dealing with this now on a little grander scale, but the question becomes, how is that relevant?
But the issue of maybe
he's highly relevant. It may be highly relevant. Remember when this bookbinder said, she said, Mr. Williams never got me a dime. Mr. Austin got me money, not only that, but here was a 23% award. Mr. Austin said, I could probably get 27 or more percent. What happened? She got it. It's not really a question of whether Mr. Williams was correct or Alan Shapiro says, I bet Mr. Williams. Here was a client that said, Mr. Austin got me the results. The same with the other lady. She said, Mr. Austin is the man that got me the results. I went to hearings with Williams or his other people four times, always lost. This man did me the job, and I choose him. So I still don't understand, if we're talking about legal issues, whether the Part A award could have been increased or decreased, or whether he was right or wrong, I really believe in this instance, what good is it to say that the man's incompetent? You can have a professional difference of opinion without name calling. That's why we're here. I mean, we all may have our opinions as to what the other side may be, but we don't go around and call names. We go and bring facts as to, so that you can come to the conclusion, as opposed to me saying that he's of this or that or whatever. And that's exactly what he did. He called names. He did not bring any evidence to the table to show how it was that he was right or Austin was wrong.
Kotesh, I was interested in the argument in your brief on the work product exception.
Great. So am I.
Okay, on page 18 of your brief and the two or three pages before that, you talk about relator's involvement commenced upon the filing of the grievance by Greg Austin. And then this, all proceedings and documents relating to relator's review and investigation of the grievance are private, and you cite GovBar Rule 511E1. Is that what that rule really contemplates?
I look at it...
Or is it that we keep it private vis-a-vis the public? I mean, I guess what I'm concerned about with that this whole thing is, what do we what problem do we have laying on the table, whether it's work product or not, what is against an attorney who we're trying to discipline?
To your first answer, and I'll do the second one first. I have no problems laying on the table. I met with Mary twice. I gave her my whole file twice. These are for certain documents that I thought were not proper for the moment. We have boxes and boxes. Copy away.
All right.
I didn't care.
Certain documents that were not proper for the moment that you wanted to bring up at trial.
No. I had no intentions of having the statement of Mary Neely admitted or submitted as evidence. The term deposition statement, I used statement, she used deposition, but the point was, I interviewed a person, or the three of us interviewed a person. We took a statement. Is it any different than a prosecutor interviewing a prospective witness?
I think maybe, and that's why I'm asking the question. That's why I'm asking the question, because I don't think that rule pertains to work product investigation in a disciplinary matter. What I've always understood it to mean is that it stays private until there's a filing of the probable cause or a complaint.
I don't tell you how we do it. Up until recently, the response from the respondent was not provided to the complainant because that was part of the private documents that were kept private. The rule was changed recently to say that we encourage the response of the respondent to be available to the complainant unless the respondent specifically says don't do it. Now, why else would it be kept private?
But that's private. That's private between the charging authority, that is, and the respondent. That is, that you are not, and we debated that rule that you're talking about at great length, whether or not the respondent's response should be provided automatically to the grievant. If that happens, it obviously isn't private anymore because the grievant's not bound by NAR rules usually, so it's not private. But there's two sides to it, and I understand that. But this rule was designed to keep it out of the public domain unless there's a formal charge.
Right.
Now, is that different than keeping from a respondent the information that the investigators have found for purposes of giving them a chance to defend themselves?
Well, we're not against giving anybody a chance to defend themselves. In fact, as you know, the rule requires that, or used to require, I think it's just been recently modified, that we had to supply a copy of the proposed complaint to give them 10 days or sufficient reasonable time to use 10 days to answer it.
Well, then why in the brief do you argue that this all should have been confidential because it was work product?
Barry Neely's statement should be confidential because that has nothing to do with anything other than what I did on my own in talking to a potential witness.
As an investigator for the Bar Association to maybe bring a charge.
You see, we're after the investigation level, and this is where the distinction I believe, we are now in the process of preparing the complaint for filing a probable cause. Between the time our committee, again, I'm only telling how our committee works, so I don't know about the other 32 committees, but between the time our committee votes trial committee to prepare a complaint and the time the complaint is accepted, that trial committee can on its own determine, you know, we're charged, the major committee, the big committee that votes for it, only has to find probable cause. We have to prove the case. And there have been times between the voting to trial committee and the preparation of the complaint where we have amended the trial committee has the authority not to proceed. And in many instances, I'll be very candid with you, well, I almost can't defend this, but I don't like to bring claims against lawyers. I mean, it doesn't make me happy. I don't get any satisfaction out of doing it. And there are cases that we don't pursue. In fact, I guess it'd be very secret, which I can't say. But there are times when we don't pursue a complaint after it's been given to us because of that very factor. Either we find other circumstances or we don't believe we can prove it by clear and convincing evidence. So we went and took a statement of the one woman that had some sufficient information. And I believe that is our work product. I think that falls within the definition of work product, even if everything else is made available. I don't know that this court has ever said that attorney work product doesn't apply to an attorney. And I'm the attorney for the real attorney. And I believe that that work product applies, and I think it falls squarely within the definition of work product. It is not, as Mrs. Douglas says, anything that I accumulate is turned over.
Turn out, you're not really representing the grievance committee in the sense that a lawyer represents a client, are you? You're part of the grievance process, and you have taken on the task of investigating a possible violation of the code. That's different than representing a client-lawyer relationship.
If it is, somebody tell me. I mean, we go back and forth. This is as adversarial as it can get. I mean, who do I represent? Actually, technically, I'm an arm of this court, so I represent you guys. I mean, what can I say? I am here in a legal capacity representing an entity. The entity bringing the complaint is a relator, the Cuyahoga County Bar Association. I am its counsel. And when I got involved, I was not the initial investigator before the Bar Association. They voted it, and then they appointed a trial panel, and I was it. Along with Martha and Richard Gunn, basically, I was at. At that moment, then, I became actively involved. And if I'm going to file a cited probable cause panel, I'm going to have to feel that I have probable cause and I can prove the complaint. And to tell me that I shouldn't go and take a witness statement, or if I take a witness statement, that is free for anybody to inspect, even before the complaint is filed, I think that that's wrong. I don't think that that's what you guys need, or what you need when you talk about free discovery. I don't think that that's what we as lawyers want for Civil Rule 26. Because basically, that's what I'm following. It says, and the most significant factors, not once, from the moment this thing was filed until this morning, have you heard a reason why they weren't able to talk to Mary Jane? Well, they could. They subpoenaed everybody else in the world. We went all over the state taking depositions. Why didn't you go and get her? But they needed my notes. They needed, and they are my notes. It's just that I didn't feel like writing, so I had a court report coming. There's no difference. I had a court report coming and transcribe my questions of Mary Neely. But where did they come in and say, we couldn't find her, we couldn't locate her, she's dead, she's not here, she doesn't want to cooperate, she's beyond the reach of subpoena? That's what disclosure of work product is. You have to come in and say why you are entitled to it. It's not just open season. And I would submit that, I wish we were on some other issue because, to me, this is a very significant issue, the attorney work product. It isn't discussed.
So it is to me, too, because when I read the transcribed statements, provides what the trial committee considered to be the relevant information from which it prepared its legal theories and planned its strategy to discipline a lawyer. I added the last part of it. I read the first part from your brief. You developed your legal theories, used the relevant information to bring this action. Why should not a respondent have the right to have that information so they know upon what basis your trial committee is considering relevant information to prepare your legal theories and planning your strategy? I mean, are we doing this by ambush? Do we want to just be secret and then, aha, it's one-upsmanship?
Again, this was done before any complaint was even filed. The complaint then summarized and encapsulated what we thought the charges were, and they got it. And we met with them before the complaint. And they didn't say a word. We went to their office. I showed them what I had. I talked to them what the issues were. I told them that this is what I think is the way we're going. I didn't ask him, show me what you got. I'll show you mine if you show me yours. All I did was give them as much information ahead of time to see if there's a manner in which we can resolve this. Fact stipulated, whatever. But sometimes they do resolve by stipulation. This one didn't. And this one took a little time. And this one took a few rulings by the trial panel and a master commissioner who reviewed the facts. And I made a motion for reconsideration, which I think is not totally inappropriate. I know that this court considered something under consideration a couple weeks ago when you decided that what you previously decided should be reviewed and determined whether you wanted to go with it. I guess I'm done. I have a few more things to say, but the only thing you're under, if I may, is mitigation. If I have 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The problem with this case is, Your Honor, is that we don't have a question, as in the earlier case, who did it, but what was behind that which was done. This is not a situation where you've ever had, I'm sorry I did. This is a situation by golly, thing ever came up again, I do it again. And I would submit that this is not what it's, I also serve on the panel that interviews those who wish to be lawyers. And if I were to give a fact scenario, Esther, suppose you have this fact situation similar to here, and I had a prospective candidate telling me that I would do exactly what Mr. Williams did, I would submit to you that he would not have passed, at least from my interview. And I would submit that a 6-month suspension or even a public reprimand does not do justice as to what was done here. Now, whether you wish to suspend any of that time is your discretion, but I think that the message you wish to send is that we still need professionalism and civility as lawyers.
Thank you, Mr. Potash. Mr. Kettlewell, you have about a minute and a half for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address two DRs that haven't been addressed. DR 11028-5 is conduct prejudicial administration of justice. There is no evidence of any conduct in this instance that was in the presence of the court or involved with material submitted to the court, and that rule is mischarged. DR 11028-6 is conduct adversely reflecting on fitness to practice law. The testimony of all those persons involved in this case clearly evidenced Mr. Williams is capable of practice law. He has practiced law for 45 years without problems, and there's nothing that reflects that person's fitness. We're then to an issue
of before he breezed by that one. Is there a point at which, assuming everything to be true about the statements he made, is there a point at which a lawyer's incivility suggests that the lawyer is not fit to practice law? Is there some threshold that you...
Mr. Chief Justice, that's exactly the next point, because Mr. Potash said, started by professionalism and civility, but what he has left out is the fact that when this court adopted the civility code, it made it very clear this was not a separate and new standard for disciplinary rules. We have to discipline a lawyer, we have to have a violation of disciplinary rule. A6, adversely reflects upon fitness to practice the law, can be a catch-all for those other types of conduct not specifically dealt with by a disciplinary rule. But it is not a catch-all that if you throw enough on the wall, we'll just find it. And then what Mary had talked about was the other charge, which was the 11028-4, which is dishonesty or deceit. If there is a dishonesty or deceit, at least the lawyer is entitled to know at some point in time what was it. A question was asked, I agree with Justice Stratton, as to what can a lawyer say? What can a law firm say? Most of you, I would dare submit, have been involved in some time in counseling lawyers when there has been somebody leaving a firm, or you counsel a firm, or somebody left. We all get engaged in that. I get it all the time. Clients always, they vacillate back and forth. There's a question of files. We don't have that one in this case. There's a question of mail. There's a finding of a violation of the mail. You have to open the mail to find out who it's to when it's coming in from bureaus and probate courts. It has to be open to find out and then delivered. Notice to the people. Fees is always an issue. We have civil litigation going on between these two parties right now. That's where this case should be. The two parties, that Austin and Mr. Williams, have civil litigation. There were legal malpractice cases being resolved, and then the most important thing is disclosure. If this court says to a court, because I've asked this question by lawyers when somebody's departed a firm, can we tell that client that lawyer has engaged in legal malpractice? Can we tell that client that lawyer has an alcohol problem? The client that has decided was previously approached by the departing lawyer, was persuaded to go with him. Can we tell them that? Can we tell them truthful statements that might be relevant in their decision? Those are the types of issues that have been brought before you in this particular case. And I respectfully submit that discipline is not intended to do anything to protect the public from lawyers who have done something wrong. And in this case, there is a civil remedy. The civil remedy is being applied. And this case should be dismissed just the same as Mr. Austin's case was dismissed. And this should not result in any sanction. And thank certainly you. Nothing more than a public reprimand. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Cutwell. In case is submitted, you'll be advised our opinion. Will the marshal please adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This is the session. Supreme Court of Ohio. Now stand.